Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about the program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show.
Welcome to episode 86, where we are discussing Mark Granovetter's article, The Strength of Weak Ties, published in the American Journal of Sociology in 1973. This is part one of the episode, where we will discuss the contents of the article and its contributions to new ways of thinking about social networks. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Greta calling in from Windsor.
And this is Pedro calling to you from Copenhagen.
This is Sarah dialing in from London.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. Welcome to another episode where we cover a whole different topic than we have recently. And we're going to be covering a 1973 article by Mark Granovetter, The Strength of Weak Ties. Granovetter is one of those authors that we have wanted to cover in this program for quite some time. And we actually had like several different articles nominated because he's been such a prolific author. But we settled on this one particular one because it is one of his earliest works. And it basically sets the stage for a lot of the work that he did subsequently on network theory. So anybody want to give us a quick introduction to the article?
Thanks, Tom. I'd be delighted. So we are reading today The Strength of Weak Ties in AJS, currently at nearly 65,000 citations since it was published in 1973. And for me, as well as setting the stage for networks in organization studies and the use of networks by non-physicists and non-STEM researchers, this is also an article that I see the birth of economic sociology from, and meso-level theorizing. Even from the very first sentence in the abstract, analysis of social networks is suggested as a tool for linking micro and macro levels of sociological theory. And there are other different terms that, for my purposes in my research, essentially are defined in this paper, like multiplexity and status multiplexity. Neural networks versus social networks. I mean, many of these terms, bridges as well, bridging capital, social bridges, many terms that I think some of our listeners and some doctoral students today are, what the Germans say, taking in with their baby milk or taking in with their breakfast cereal, are really laid down in what is quite a short article. So it's very interesting to bring this to the Talking About Organizations audience because it is in a preeminent journal in sociology, so therefore might be more peripheral to our core org theory and management researchers. What the article walks us through is it's coming on the back of early ethnographies in the Chicago School, studies of postal networks. So can you post this postcard to how many people, how many different people can you reach? If you wanted to convince someone to post this survey and this postcard on, how far could it get? Almost like an academic chain letter, if you remember chain letters and chain emails. And really what it's talking about is breaking down the previous dominant theory that you should cultivate more or fewer stronger ties and spend your resources of time and energy and emotion in that. And then I think the arc from this through the book on Bowling Alone about the breakdown of this social fabric in the US, and then the way we're coming through what is the new social fabric now, the families you choose, how do you have a social fabric outside of work, or if you're not going to a building, do you still have a work social fabric? I think the long arc of that all comes back to this. So instead of the pot of the gold at the end of the rainbow, I guess it's the pot of gold that starts the rainbow.
This is very interesting. So why don't we try to go through what are the main ideas in the text, right? And it's interesting because the paper seems almost to be written in a very didactic way. And it seems to be trying to do two things, at least. One is, as Sarah said, to introduce these new ideas to a particular audience, right? And in doing that, allow us to rethink particular models in relation to behavior, diffusion, and of course, the micro-macro link, which is the main thing that Granovetter opens the paper, you know, as a promise, what he's trying to work towards.
Yes, so absolutely. And really, it's about moving sociometrics to social theory, or bringing the new techniques in social measurement into understandings of social cohesion and diffusion. And actually, this paper sits in the middle, as you might expect for a sociology paper, between social psychology and physics, in a way, in that it's bringing very formal mathematical modeling, which will only get more complex as the discipline grows, into the discussion of what do our real lives look like. And then brings the lens back on itself, asking how representative is even anything that has been proposed within this article. So it does foreshadow growth in the area, and even growth from the author himself, from in a trajectory. It is very much setting out a stake of, here is the beginning of what I have to offer. Watch me fly.
So let me just sort of pose a question, because obviously the article itself, the title, indicates that, you know, that piece where we're moving away from the idea of strong ties are important to laying out the importance of weak ties. But let's take a look at, you know, how does he define a tie? What does he mean by strength? Because that's, it's right there, you know, very early in the article. Most intuitive notions of strength of an interpersonal tie, the strength of a tie is a combination of the amount of time, the emotional intensity, intimacy, and the reciprocal services which characterize the tie. That's a good, simple definition, and I think it makes sense in terms of when we think about who are we really, you know, close with from either, you know, regardless of setting. I mean, I interpret this as not being tied to any particular setting. It applies to work, applies to family, applies to any social setting. And we think about, like, especially in the 70s and before then, strong ties were the things that you did cultivate. I'm thinking about the times when folks would work together in the factory and go straight to the bar afterwards, and the sense of strong ties, you know, or the strength of ties being tied to a sense of unit cohesion, or a sense of cohesion or bonding, morale, all of those things kind of tied in with that.
So I think in the paper, tie is placed somewhere between individual interaction. He talks about just riding the same bus doesn't give you a tie, shopping in the same grocery store, or nodding in the street. That's one of the illustrations he uses. If you can nod at someone in the street, does that count as a tie? And at the other extreme is exactly as you said, having identity groups, work groups, faith groups, living in the same apartment block would be an identity tie in that sense. So the ties that are discussed here are somewhere in between that. You can't really define it without going further into what he's examining we use them for. What do they do and what do we use them for? I think that's integral to the definition.
And I think also what is important in what I perceive he's trying to do is that, as you just said, Sarah, before, is these ideas from sociometrics, which has a more atlas type of quality, visual type of quality, meaning that it's not just in-group, out-group, core, periphery, but it's the path. So it's the, how can we call it? We can call it the structure, but to use an analogy, right, would be the anatomy of the connections that exist among people, right, that is going to make the difference in the story here.
Sounds like a way of talking about the 6 degrees of separation. That was sort of the idea that went into my head.
When I was thinking about that, the idea that came to mind was the work of Rosalind Franklin, right? The famous unacknowledged woman that was center for the discovery of the structure of the DNA, and her work in crystallography and showing how the very way into it, the layout of the DNA was important to understand its function. So I see a similar shift here happening, right? That the very layout of the tides is integral to explaining a whole set of behaviors that he's trying to reconceptualize through these new lenses.
Yes, you're absolutely right in terms of bringing up that dendrogram imagery there. And one of the ways that's described is the channels through which ideas, influences, or information socially distant from ego may reach him. And this is absolutely setting up the future paper that I'm not sure if we've done, but or is on the list to do, of Podolny's pipes and prisms, the pipes and prisms of the market, which is exactly that. Is it a pipe through which these resources and this influence get conducted, or is it a prism of social evaluation? And it says later on in the same section that the findings of changing sociometry in this way suggest a primacy of structure over motivation. So again, you're definitely right to be highlighting the structure there and almost the birth of how we can look at, observe, and draw and report structure, a structural sociology there.
Maybe we can unpack that a bit and give a bit of context. Like, I think, you know, the strength of weak ties, when you mention that phrase now, everybody is like, of course, you know, weak ties are important. But when this paper was written, this was really not the understanding at the time. Sociologists, when they studied networks, they only focused on strong ties and even forgot to measure the weak ties. The idea that, you know, to even study weak ties was revolutionary at the time. And if you think about the impact of this paper, when you think about the social networks that are all around us, especially connecting us through the internet, Facebook, LinkedIn, it's all based on the ideas that, you know, the weak ties, you can see how you're connected to other people. Like, a lot of the ideas from this paper have actually been implemented in the network structures that we are embedded in. You know, this is one of the sociological studies. Granovetter's work has been of significant, great significance, for instance, in labor markets, understanding how they operate, as well as in, you know, the social networks that have emerged in the past couple of decades online. And thinking about, you know, the paper not only makes this point that, you know, weak ties, you know, not your close friends, but your acquaintances, or a friend of a friend that you have met at a birthday party, how they can be important, for instance, in finding a job or being able to initiate community engagement or things like that. It says that the analysis of social networks is the tool for linking micro and macro levels of sociological theory. That's like the overall argument, that small things at the micro level matter in explaining the macro things. And at the time, sociology was either micro or it was either macro. And the criticism was there's not enough connection between the two. And this is one of the papers that showed how they are connected. And I thought Mark Granovetter does it beautifully by drawing on all these different examples. You know, the postal letters is a nice one. Then we have the Italian community in Boston that failed to collectively organize themselves to prevent a big restructuring of their neighborhood, as well as talking about, you know, tie formation among school children as well, another example. And I think, you know, we can talk a bit about each of them, how we see, like, you know, how did he understand these weak ties? How were they studied? And how does it link that micro and macro?
Yeah, and also linking them without tension. I think that's what's really important. It said, you know, there's a section that says, talking about how these studies before were only focused on social cohesion. And then he says, weak ties are an important resource in making possible mobility opportunity. But seen from a more macroscopic vantage, weak ties play a role in affecting social cohesion. So the idea of talking about labor mobility, as you would know, Greta, and social cohesion at the same time with the same tool and the same people was indeed groundbreaking.
So we got that the central leading character in the story, of course, the strength of the weak ties. And the justification for that is because it's going to be a tool in order to enrich sociology and allowing this connection micro-macro to exist. And also on the back of that, to bring all those different tools from sociometrics and this network perspective. But I think there's a fundamental thing that we should talk about, which is the mechanism through which it justifies why we should pay attention to the weak ties, which is the one of bridging, right? Because that's the one that he says, and he spends sometimes at the beginning in trying to introduce this idea of how the weak ties work as a sort of bridges. And in bigger networks, not just necessarily the only connection that exists between different people, but it is the most relevant and significant locally, or is the shortest path, right? So that's how he setups, in a way, the argument, so to speak.
Yeah, the original bridge, or the very simple unclosed triangle network diagram, and the way it's described as the concept of a bridge, this is a line in a network which provides the only path between two points. So the emphasis was in the original there, the only path between two points. And there's a deep discussion about strong ties cannot be bridges. And that sets up the reason for the focus and delving into weak ties. So that, I think, is a critical section which is difficult to engage with if you're not used to formal logic or formal argumentation. You almost just want to take it as read, but it's really important to justifying why the focus needs to move on to weak ties. And ultimately, it comes down to the contention that the removal of the average weak tie would do more damage to transmission probabilities than would that of an average strong one. And that is, that buried in the middle of that logic section is the contribution and setting up the contribution that Greta already explained.
Yeah, I think the diagrams, this is something where the diagrams come in really, really handy if the argument is tough to unpack in your own mind. Because it's on page 1365, and he shows the concept of the bridges and how it works. And you can see that he's drawn like a series of clusters. Two versions of the same effective diagram are shown. One is very, very clearly two very strong social networks, and you can imagine that each one represents a family or a work division where everybody really is tightly connected. And then the bridge represents the one person from each group. It's almost like the Romeo and Juliet thing. You'd see connecting from one family or one work unit to the other work unit. Otherwise, there is no other interactions. So then he shows a second diagram, which is a little bit more... it's basically the same thing. It's just that the social network is a little bit looser, perhaps not as tightly structured. You can just imagine that it's a bit more open in terms of what kind of relationships we're talking about. We're not talking about clear work units or whatever, just a simple network of who people interact with. And yet you still have these bridges, weak ties between a person, a single person in one cluster with another single person in another cluster. If you take that first example and then expand, use the same logic, you can kind of see how that can happen because of, like, I met this person at a conference, or I met this person at a church meeting, or met this person at fill in the blank, and we had a connection. We had something that was in common between us. And now we have a line of communication that would not have ordinarily happened in any other way. And now this is where you have opportunity and all of the other things we're talking about, the idea of mobility, the idea of opportunities or whatever exists, just simply because through this acquaintance or friend of a friend kind of a deal, we now have a more robust network.
Maybe we can unpack what Sarah said earlier about, you know, structure being more important than motivation. And I think the labor market is a good example of that. And it also connects to what you said, Tom. So, you know, if you're looking for a job, of course, your close friends and family, they're highly motivated to help you find a job. But because they're in the same network, and, you know, these bridging ties being important in Granovetter's argument, you know, they're limited in how they can help you find opportunities. But if you look at the bridging ties, they connect your group, your strong group that you're embedded in, with others. And so that's where, you know, structure comes in, that, you know, even these people might have less motivation, you reach a broader network. You know, these are your, you know, second and third lines of connections on LinkedIn. You reach a much broader network and a much broader space of opportunities than in your close one. And that's where Granovetter says, like, you know, the structure is more important than, you know, the motivational aspect, how much somebody is willing to help you. And I think that's a very important point. you know, previous scholars in the field of labor, you know, they already said they studied at the time that word of mouth, personal contacts are very important in finding jobs, not only in blue collar work, but also in white collar work and managerial positions. But what Granovetter shows in this paper is that the nature of the tie is what matters. And you need to pay attention to that. And in the discussion, he also says, like, you know, you can further unpack it. You know, strong or weak is just one way of characterizing the nature. But for instance, you know, positive and negative is another one that he assumes the tie is positive and symmetrical. He puts it in a footnote at the beginning of the paper. But you can also think about asymmetric, negative, or where one person thinks it's positive and the other one negative. But that's, you know, this is just the idea that, you know, all the connections are positive and we need to look at the nature of the tie.
So you are bringing something that I think that makes the paper particular compelling, right? That to some extent, the choice of the different examples and the different research in which he uses to ground the argument is very astute, right? And to some extent, he's using research in showing his new conceptualization, the whole idea of the weak ties and the bridging road that they have, to move the research from this kind of fuzzy understanding to something more specific, like in the case of labor market. But in some cases, and he actually starts the paper with that, he's trying to show how that is a kind of assumed and hidden mechanism, right? That people saw the pattern, they never saw what was causing it. And he talks about diffusion and the discussion whether the early adopters are in the core, the periphery, right? And the extent in depend, you know, and how people were discussing that depends on type of the innovation, the idea. And he goes on to show that actually, well, in one way or another, if we accept that is the people that is in the periphery, but then we have to explain how that gets diffused. Because if the people are in the periphery, would expect that never it's going to become a widely taken up idea or phenomenon, right? And he uses this missing link, so to speak. It's when those people have ties, at weak ties, that then we have the diffusion process and so on. So he starts there and then brings all these different kinds of previous research, which can add to his, you know, argument, but was missing something. And he shows in a very elegant way how this whole idea of weak ties and the bridging help us explain better what we already partially understood.
Yeah, the language from innovation literature comes in exactly as you both say, in that they're talking about how first adopters are marginal, early adopters are a more integrated part of the local social system than innovators. But to Greta's point, central and marginal individuals may well be motivated, as they claim, but if the marginal are genuinely so, it's difficult to see how they can ever spread innovation successfully. And I think it's great that even as he's walking through it, there is a knowledge of the limits of this argument because it's new and because it's so groundbreaking. He'll even say things like, this finding lends credence to the weak tie argument, but is inconclusive. So he's not willing to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but he's fully prepared for people to try and knock it down, right? Or for the existing dominant paradigm to be resistant to these contributions.
Just as a general comment, the temperance and the specificity at which he's able to get at, I think it's, of course, formidable, right?
Well, and that's what's so interesting, that both of these, the 73 and the 85, are in AJS, but they're essentially no data. They're essentially no data, right? There's very limited, I've used this in my previous research. I changed the category here, but they clearly, to me, absolutely look like ASR papers that are now in AJS.
Why don't we get into some of the examples in the paper that kind of illustrate the key argument that Mark Granovetter makes? And I liked the example that of the postal cards. I think, yeah, the postcards at page 1368 in the paper. And where, I don't know if I recall the details correctly, but this old thing of, you know, sending a card and trying to make the full circle. But the study was looking at interracial ties, or the ties between white people and people of color, if I could call them like that. And basically, in the study, they asked if the person you sent the card to, you would refer to them as a friend, or an acquaintance. And they looked if the chain was made, if the sending the postcard round got completed or not. And in this study, they found that in 50% of the instances where the white person who started off described the person of color as an acquaintance, then the chain was ultimately completed. But when they referred to them as a friend, it was only 26%. So that was one of the examples that got brought up in the study. It really highlights how these weak ties matter.
And a tiny point that I find fascinating is that it is almost, again, connected to the current discussion we're having on open science, because that finding is one of the things that makes this paper teachable, usable, applicable, and it's manually calculated by unpublished data, kindly supplied by the original designer. You know, so imagine if they had had pre-registration or open science registration, how many of us could have played with the data, but instead they just wrote to the author and they handed it over to recalculate for the purposes of these couple of paragraphs, which then give this paper some of the life that it has.
That's true. I also wonder about that, right? That how much we produce different corpus of data and to what extent sometimes science advancement hinges on interrogating that with a different tool perspective, as Granovetra is doing here. But I wanted to maybe expand on what both Greta and Sarah just said, is that this example, I think, is one of the ones he uses that quite clearly, and I think quite compellingly, show the implications, right? Because to some extent, this whole conversation could have been very much dry, right? The weak ties matter, they have this role, and, you know, all these different logical assumptions behind that and the network structure. But I think what makes the paper very strong is the capacity it has to show how this speaks to a range of phenomena, right? And this one, he doesn't expand so much in the paper itself, but interracial relations, and Sarah was talking at the beginning, this is at the root of how people understand each other, create friendships, create groups, you know, create society, basically, right? So this is a fundamental, I don't call it a device, but it's a fundamental aspect of social life, right? That has implications for how you find your work, mobility, as we just said, but also to the very, as Sarah was saying at the beginning, the very fabric, the very sense of identity, the very sense of, you know, who we are, who do we trust, how we are able to cooperate, how we are able to achieve collective action, how are we able to, you know, participate in any kind of social sphere, in public sphere. I think it's particularly interesting because I feel that still today, a lot of the conversation, in light of this whole, we are becoming very divisive type of assumption and idea, is very much about ideology, politics, the extent in which your physical or political attributes are similar and different. But what Granovetra is showing that, of course, this, all of that matter. But in a way, they can also be seen as a consequence to the extent you have the connections. I mean, of course, all of these are both cause and consequence. But one element that seems to be important here is not just who you are, but who do you talk to, who are able to meet, and to what extent you have some sense of familiarity of those people, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most painful parts in reading this paper now, as we're recording it in the second year of the pandemic, is the distinction he makes with people who are named as acquaintances or someone you could go to for career advice, but who, when he unpacks it, you find are unpopular and alone. So he's talking about who eats alone at lunchtime, a very Goffman type of description, I think, who eats alone at lunchtime, and then the secondary school children, who would you want to be associated with? Who are you associated with? Who could you go to if necessary? And that just the beginning of those self-report network studies that we then obviously go on to model in much more detail, but very clearly showing us that our self-perceptions and the other perceptions are misaligned and the consequences of that. And, you know, at the moment, reading about social cohesion, connectivity, and who you need as a support network versus popularity, visibility, and connection, that is, you know, particularly painful to read right now.
I gravitated much more to the story about the West End, and it is the same theme, really, just taken at a much higher level, because now what we're talking about is whole communities that are very, very strongly tied with themselves. But the difference between having the weak ties present that allows the community to develop resilience against a problem or a threat of some kind. And so you had, I believe it was the Italian community versus, and I forget what it was.
It's the Charlestown working class community. The Italian community in Boston's West End.
It's Boston, yeah. I think
Boston.
It doesn't say where Charlestown is situated. But it is in Boston.
Okay. The case study is interesting because of how, under this particular threat, when you had a community with no weak ties, they were basically unable to respond. They didn't have a response because everybody, you can see the picture of this community of a group of very, very strong-willed, close-knit, but like-minded individuals who just didn't have a response and didn't have a way of getting information that could help them mobilize a response. In contrast, the other community, Charlestown, who successfully organized, and they were able to organize because they had the weak ties. They were able to reach out, gain information, understand what the possibilities were to engage with the government, and they held out. You see this idea being discussed at the individual level in the postal card example, and you see it now at a larger level, the community level, the same kind of idea of the importance of the weak ties.
And what I like about this example is that it specifies the context in which these weak bridging ties are very present, and that's the organization connecting the micro and the macro. And it shows that in the example, the West End community, the Italian community, it was a working class community, but none of the people actually worked in the locality where they lived. They worked somewhere else. So the organization was not a setting where these weak bridging ties could form to help, that's the argument, to help collectively organize. Whereas in the Charlestown case, it was also a working class community, but the mill residents did work within the area. And, you know, note the time that this paper was being written, you know, some of the language is a little bit outdated, but it shows that there was a rich organizational life, and that organizational life matters for having these weak ties, these bridging ties, the connecting of, you know, close networks, to having these linkages together.
And we also said in the beginning of our discussion today about investing in social cohesion and investing in strength. And this case example brings out what Granovetter says as the foundations of network constraint, right? So it says, since it's unlikely that anyone could sustain more than a few dozen strong ties, these unique clusters breaking down would have been the result. So then, of course, naturally, you start to think a few dozen strong ties is an incredible investment unless you're talking about, let's say, large Boston Catholic families. But then what is the natural limit to weak ties? And what is the limit to weak ties that are non-bridge weak ties? And there's been a really rich literature since on network size and density versus network constraint and pruning and general pruning and maintenance of your networks and how that affects network dynamics, network evolution. So once again, just a simple assertion in a classic of economic sociology and org theory, and how many future papers and contemporary papers can trace their origins to this.
Why don't we, before we close, make an exercise in trying to think, and Sarah already started that, how all of this connects to all the other episodes we have been doing so far?
Well, Pedro's queuing up that we've done Dan Brass, episode 61, on networks, published in Administrative Science Quarterly and founding of network empirical studies within organizations. I know Greta just helped us walk through the non-formal, but it's what Granovetter calls formal versus informal organizations. So the Brass episode is about the founding of network studies in formal organizations in partnership with your research site. So we've done that together in episode 61.
I was also thinking about episodes on Toshman and boundary spanning as, you know, more later scholarship on connecting that idea of bridging that emerged in sociology and in social network analysis with the idea of boundary spanning between groups within organizations.
And in the later paper that's twinned with this, Granovetter also brings up the Dalton book, that is in one of our episodes in the catalog as well, Men Who Manage. And so that book is brought up about intra-firm audits and a longer discussion about whether auditing, it's almost the Schrodinger's cat of organization studies with auditing. So there's another link to our episodes there.
What I found interesting in the paper is this very structured view of something that's usually understood in a more amorphous fashion, meaning that getting at the anatomy of this tie formation, like, you know, so the basic level of social science is, of course, relationships, right? So trying to be very structured about that, but it's still in somehow taking consideration that that is connected to friendship, meaning, who you spend time with, you know, all this kind of more, and also how the paper is written, all these more qualitative characteristics, right? So this more structured dimension of this qualitative word, which is a way to look at, if you want, workplace dynamics, labor opportunities, you know, of course, Granovetter doesn't talk about managing here or control, but one could expand that in that direction. That is neither purely design in terms of what is the structure that has been designed and imposed and the effects it has, which has a lot, you know, a lot of the literature that we cover is about that, right? The effects and the impact of all sorts of design structure. On the other hand, is neither this story of this more emergent, culture-driven, symbolic aspects of how the different people that come to work, what do they bring, what identity they have, how they understand each other, how they interaction, right? So it's trying to understand all of that rich world, but through a more structural framework, right? That's what I find interesting. It's not just a bridge of micro, macro, but I see this kind of work and this kind of paper as a bridge between what are sometimes different perspectives of areas of organizational studies, right?
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.